From iAfrican Media, this is iAfrican Bites, a podcast that features commentary on African news, insights, opinions, and analysis with tech industry leaders and professionals. The podcasts are from interviews conducted by the iAfrican team, whether at events or when needed for commentary. I'm Badawun Kosokwane, host and editor-in-chief for iAfrican.com, spelled www.iafrican.com.
Chris, welcome to iAfrican. Hot day in Ghana, third day of the deep learning in Daba. We spoke about AI fatigue.
Oh, yeah.
Explain that.
I mean, AI fatigue or just conference fatigue in general.
Conference fatigue in general,
yeah,
yes.
I mean, it's early mornings, late nights.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Day three, still going strong.
Uh-huh.
This year, the deep learning in Daba is a little bit longer than usual.
Okay.
So you already got to like pace yourself.
Pace yourself, yeah. Right. I mean, walk us through the previous years. You said it was this year is longer than it was previously.
Yeah.
How many days was it previously?
Yeah, so previously, so it's gotten longer by one more day.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, it's Sunday evening till the following Friday.
Okay.
And now we're going to the following Saturday.
Saturday, yes.
So one of the reasons that we extended it this year
uh-huh.
is because, I mean, the deep learning in Daba, it's still a very new conference. I mean, it's fairly 100%. Young compared to like other conferences, but it's also a very lovely experimental space. And one of the things that we've been trying to like innovate on is providing more opportunity for, you know, community members in the deep learning in Daba community to have their voices heard, and, you know, doing that through the organizing of workshops.
100%.
So we specifically extended this year by one day to have an extra day for community driven workshops.
100%.
Yeah, and what's really lovely there is that we've been given like the autonomy to just run with it.
Run with it.
And I think that's great because it helps, you know, teach the community, you know, in a little bit more of a controlled environment, you know, what it takes to pull off these kind of talks, these kind of discussions. And I think that's really in line with what we're trying to do at the Deep Learning in Daba, which is capacity building, right? Which is, you know, what I think separates it from other conferences. So you go to another conference
uh-huh.
and what they're trying to do there is like post, publish cutting edge research.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the Deep Learning in Daba, I would describe more as a conference summer school hybrid.
Uh-huh.
Where we still have peer review, but the peer review is not at the level of the work, it's at the level of the individual.
Yes.
So there's quite a lengthy application process, but once a person has been accepted to attend, then, you know, the goal is more on capacity building
uh-huh.
for data science, machine learning, or AI in Africa. And like the poster session is perhaps a good example of this,
uh-huh.
where individuals are invited to submit, you know, completed work, work in progress, or just ideas. And this is my third deep learning in Daba.
Beautiful.
My first one was in Kenya, Nairobi, and the poster that I presented there was actually just an idea.
Uh-huh.
And 3 years down the line, or more than 3 years, because, you know, COVID happened.
Yeah.
The idea that I presented was to set up a grassroots community
uh-huh.
for data science or AI in healthcare
uh-huh.
in Africa. And the shirt I'm wearing today,
Sasanke.
That's the community, right?
Yes.
And we've been going for about two and a half years now. We have a couple hundred researchers, enthusiasts, and
uh-huh.
practitioners from across Africa, you know, Malawi, Morocco, Egypt, Nigeria. And that was just something that I had the opportunity to speak
uh-huh.
about at a poster session in 2019.
Chris, let's go a little bit into your journey, going through your LinkedIn. So you started medicine.
Yeah.
But I didn't really see any experience in practicing medicine. How did you go from studying medicine to now Sasanke Biotech?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think a lot of the people you might find in like academia or even the tech space tend to take fairly meandering paths to get there and often have very unique stories on how they got there. And I definitely fall into that category. You know, even in my third year of medical school, I wanted to change over to biomedical engineering.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to the point of where I'd signed up
wow.
to go study biomedical engineering
wow.
And I think, yeah, so after about a 2-week period, my family kind of convinced me, like, it's probably a better idea
to finish
your medical degree.
Dad and mom were like, don't wild out, go back.
so that's what I did. But then when I was done, I knew quite firmly that I wanted to do something else. Uh-huh. And I really just had quite a passion for science, uh-huh, and especially the intersection of computational or theoretical neuroscience, uh-huh, and machine learning and how those two things interact with one another. Uh-huh. So what can we learn from AI,
yes,
that informs us about biological brains,
yes,
and what do we learn about brains that can inform us about AI? So I went on then to do a master's in computer science at Wits University, uh-huh, with the Rail Lab, uh-huh, under Prof. Benjamin Rossman.
100%. And very cool person.
Yeah, I know.
Very cool.
Absolutely.
Prof. Very cool.
A ton of respect.
Yes.
Very good friend.
Yes.
All the time in the world for Benji.
Yes.
And Benji was also one of the co-founders of the Deep Learning and Dabba.
Deep Learning and Dabba, 100%. So one of the trustees.
Yeah.
I had an interview with them. A very insightful interview.
So I had a very sort of easy on-ramp to the Deep Learning Dabba, and I'm very grateful for that. And I've tried to make the most of that opportunity. And the master's research that I did, so it was a coursework master's, so I really needed the year of coursework that I did, because coming from like a medical background, you need that like technical upskilling. And then after that, I did my research components part-time over the space of about a year or two. And my focus was on biologically plausible machine learning. So, I mean, I anticipate the audience may or may not want the technical details, but for those that do, what I was looking at was, you know, what if in a neural network, we let the neurons be reinforcement learning agents and essentially act independently, but working together to solve like a classification task. And this is an alternative to using something like backpropagation, which is not biologically feasible. And using RL in this way is horribly inefficient, but is interesting because it suggests that maybe this might be what's happening in our brains. So I was building on someone else's work. I was investigating just why certain variance reduction techniques were failing, specifically why actor-critic methods were failing. But again, that's definitely in the weeds. So after my master's, while I was doing my research components, I started work for a US-based company. We're working on continuous and remote, mm-hmm, monitoring for patient data, and the focus was on consumer wearables, so things like sports trackers and watches, and looking to how we can diagnose heart disease from your sports watch or like sleep apnea. I really enjoyed that space. Uh-huh. It was a great exposure to like data at scale. And I was working as what we can call like a research engineer or like a machine learning ops engineer,
okay,
where it's like a little bit of back-end engineering, mm-hmm, a little bit of like DevOps, mm-hmm, a little bit of data engineering, mm-hmm, as well, and some data science thrown into the mix. And that's building the digital infrastructure for machine learning and data pipelines for health data. Yeah, and I think one of the questions that I think we get a lot when talking about data science or machine learning for healthcare is, you know, what is the difference to doing data science in health, right? And I think a lot of the core practical components are the same. I mean, like data is data in some sense. I mean, if you're working with images from healthcare to like images from let's say like a street camera or something like that, like a speed camera or whatever, the format of those images, you know, could the nature of working with images is the same in some senses, right? I mean, the size and the maybe some of the proprietary formats that you might get in healthcare would be a little bit different. But I'd say the big difference is when you want to do responsible AI or ethical AI in other fields, you know, we should be doing this ethically, especially so in healthcare. But now we also have a legal responsibility to protect patients and like the population at large. So concepts like how is the data regulated, or how are our AI or ML models regulated, are like a very big topic in that space.
Chris, healthcare is one thing, right? And the AI component of it that you're advocating for and you're implementing, how do you lobby and gain the trust of traditional medical professionals that, you know, have been working for years and years in the medical field, and here you come with this AI, you know, language and solutions, and they know their way of doing things. How do you sort of win their trust in saying, hey guys, we know you've been doing this, for 20 years this way, but there's this new sort of tool, technology, that can accelerate that. How do you win over their trust, and what's been the process to win over their trust?
I mean, I think with most things, you might be able to say it's just like a case-by-case basis, because you know, even within the medical space, individuals are fairly diverse and come from like many different backgrounds and have many different like ideologies. Mm-hmm. However, from like the broad approaches that I'd say the AI community has taken, you'll see that there are some groups that emphasize things like explainable AI, mm-hmm. where there's a lot of effort put into understanding exactly what's going on, so that if a medical doctor any kind of health practitioner is using this tool, it is very clear to them why a certain like diagnosis has been given or why a certain recommendation has been put forward. And I would say I'm fairly mixed on that particular topic, uh-huh. just because in other spaces in healthcare, let's say like where we look at certain types of medication, uh-huh. I can give you this medication and I can know that it works and I can know that it's safe, but there are still some mechanisms of action that aren't clear to us, that we haven't really discovered yet. I would say that, you know, if we are able to show that the AI that we're using is safe, like, and that, you know, we're not putting our patients in harm's way, that to me seems like as good, if not a better selling point than going the explainable AI route. Uh-huh. I think the problem comes in there, where the amount of money that we put into ensuring that drugs are safe using like clinical trials is incredibly expensive and incredibly time consuming.
Yes.
So you might be able to...
We saw that with the COVID-19 and having to get South Africa to test, this country to test, and
So I would consider, and again, this is just my opinion, uh-huh. that the usefulness of explainable AI comes into spaces where you might not have the time or the financing to do, you know, that level of in-depth safety or rigorous safety testing like you would in a medical drug administration sense. Not saying that we shouldn't test for safety, but the nature of that testing is different depending on like who your end user is. So with medication, your end user is going to be the general public. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're using an AI algorithm, your intended end user can be a medical practitioner, which means there's still an extra layer of safety or decision-making before anyone in the, you know, public is impacted by this. And to try and like go back to answer your original question, so explainable AI is one way that this has been approached. The way that I am fond of, and I guess this comes out in the fact that I'm running helping run a grassroots community, is taking a community first approach, 100%. Where we have this technical and social divide that we need to bridge. So it's not only doctors not understanding something, it's not being part of those social networks where these discussions are being had and where there are people that they trust. So I think I would say generally building networks of trust, which is hard, because that does take like a lot of one-on-one interactions, is probably one of the best, more robust ways to go about doing this. But again, that's just my opinion. So I think for every practitioner that you speak to,
yes,
they'll have like a different approach.
100%. Chris, I love your emphasis on community. The Ndaba, what about this community do you love, and how does it feed into that community? This is now Sasonke that you're building.
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone here is just absolutely lovely. Like 100%. There is this focus on like kindness,
yes,
and you know, giving people the space and time to like overcome their imposter syndrome, because I think we all arrive,
yes,
with some degree of imposter syndrome. Yes. And you know, speaking especially from someone who came from a different, you know, technical field, you walk into these lectures and you have no idea at first like what's going on. So you know, even with that, I just try, and one thing I found very useful is just learning to be comfortable being uncomfortable. And you know, in those uncomfortable spaces, the Ndaba community, at least through my experience, has been very kind. And so that's one aspect. The other is just the extent and the reach that the community has for building networks is, you know, really impressive. So they've really gotten this right. And I think they've focused on, you know, trying to, let's say, you know, give everyone an opportunity to learn. And because a lot of the participation is open for, let's say, the associated communities. So I mean, the Ndaba itself, you have to apply, and it's a process. But Sasonke got its start from a spin-off or branching off of the Masakane community, mm-hmm. which is a community for underrepresented African languages. So when we saw that, we're like, this is amazing. Your community model is really working. And the Masakane got started at the Deep Learning Ndaba in 2019. So we adopted and adapted that model for the healthcare space. So the spaces are a little bit different because, for instance, healthcare data is very hard to access compared to language data that might be like available online. I mean, they also have like data access issues. But in both cases, we run weekly meetings where anyone can just join. You don't have to have any kind of background, you just have to be interested. And we really want to create a space where it's diverse enough that you can volunteer as much or as little time as you can afford, and you can know, you can be like very senior, and we'll try to find a space for you to try and contribute and try and provide an impact. Or, you know, if you're just getting started, to, you know, help find a buddy for you in the community and like just provide like as much of a nurturing environment as we can.
Chris, thank you so much. Your work is amazing. And I feel, I'm of the opinion that the community model works. Masakane proved it, Ndaba proved it, Sasonke is proving it, and it will keep growing and growing and growing.
Yeah.
And I think that's our strength as Africans, the community. And I think we just need to keep using that Ubuntu within us to really grow the sector in this part of the continent.
And our scope as Sasonke Biotech is actually very intentionally quite broad, because we wanted to be able to connect as many people as we can, and then provide a space for people with very specific interests to like seed and grow their own communities. So for instance, if someone, some group of people were very interested in like computer vision and medical imaging, or genomics and AI, to say, well, let us provide you the space to incubate your community. And then, you know, the end structure of all of these communities working together is much more of a sort of modular, federated structure, so that, you know, each group has their own autonomy, their own identity, and is able to, you know, build their own brand in the way that makes sense for their context.
Chris, thank you so much.
Cool, thanks.
Thank you for listening to iAfrican Bites. Please share your feedback with us on our socials. On Twitter at iAfrican, on LinkedIn at iAfrican.com. And check out our other podcasts, The Tefomo Happy Show, Take Legal Matters, and The Lead Creator, on all podcast streaming platforms. And also make sure to head over to www.iafrican.com. That is iafrican.com/radio. And subscribe for notifications. iAfrican Bites is an iAfrican Media original show, produced by Nzalo Mbangana and content producer and host by Don Kotokwane.